have a story for you this morning. It's a story from a book we've read from a few different times, The Spy on Noah's Ark. This story is called Deborah Charging for God. If I were in a restaurant, I'd squeeze into a chair, put my front hooves on the table, and order grass for dinner, and grass for dessert, and maybe a little side salad of grass. Forget all that stiff hay that other horses eat, too crunchy. And forget the restaurant anyway. I'm a free-range kind of horse, a big black Arabian stallion with a love for, you guessed it, grass. Whenever I see a patch of it, I'll gallop over and start the great stallion roll. I'm on my back with my legs kicking in the air, my whole body covered with that fresh, grassy smell. There's one thing that will make me leave the field. Deborah, my lovely, brave owner. When she whistles, I scramble up and streak to her side. I still remember the day when she took me into battle. I was at the front, leading the charge, followed by thousands of soldiers. Deborah rode me in the spirit of a warrior, confident and in charge. Deborah didn't plan to be a warrior. At first, she was happy being a judge, which was a rare position for a woman in those days. Her court was a bare hillside under a palm tree. Wise and steady, she helped people solve their problems before things got out of control. That's why she worried about the trouble happening over the hills. Our enemy, the Canaanites, had been invading nearby towns for years. They would take people captive and carry them off to strange lands. Our townspeople tried to ignore the threat, thinking it would never happen to them. But they were kidding themselves. Deborah knew there was a danger, so she decided to call on General Barak, the head of our army. "We can't wait much longer," she said. "The Canaanites will try to capture us one day soon. You must do something. You must take our army and fight. Defeat them for good so we can sleep in peace." "Chariots," Barak said. "Deborah, they have chariots and swords and spears. They're much better equipped than we are. They'll make horse meat out of us." "Horse meat? Horse meat." I snorted loudly. Horse meat was not a pleasant thought. "You must go," she said. "We cannot wait any longer." Barak looked her straight in the eye. "Then you go with me," he said. "That's the only way I will fight." "Nay," my stallion pulse pounded. Women weren't on the battlefield in those days. They stayed back, taking care of children and running their homes. Yet I knew there was no one braver than Deborah. She looked toward her house. A small hand waved. It was her daughter. "I'll do it," she said, "to keep them safe, to keep all of us safe." Then she whistled for me, her steed. Together, we would do it together. That very night, 10,000 men and one woman, Deborah, gathered under the cover of darkness. Preparing themselves for battle, they knelt in prayer. "We are your people, Lord. Guard us, protect us, and deliver us from harm's way." Shivers ran through me as I took my place at the head of the line. This was a stallion's dream. Mile by mile, we moved quietly through the darkness. Before dawn, we were on the top of Mount Tabor, looking down at the flat, fertile plain below. But word had leaked out that we were on our way, for the enemy was amassed there, ready to fight. "Come on down, you're no match for us," shouted Sisera, the Canaanite general. We had heard about him. He was a cruel man, a man of no mercy. "Did you miss your sleep last night?" "You're probably too weak to fight us," taunted another. "Yeah, just surrender. Less pain that way." Thousands of Canaanite soldiers, protected with heavy armor, stretched for miles on the plain just across the river. Handsome horses pulled heavy iron chariots with wheels flashing like they were on fire. Barak shook his head. "Watch out for those chariots," he said. "They have about 900 of them. Don't jump up on them, even if you get close, because sharp knives are tied to each wheel. They're flashing now because they're reflecting the sun's rays." "Knives tied to chariot wheels right at the level of our chests? Yikes." Shudders ran through the men and me. "Do not fear," said Deborah. "God will protect us. Remember our ancestors. God parted the Red Sea so they could be free. He split rocks in the deserts so they could have water. He made bread fall from the skies so they would not starve. He will protect us just the same." And then we waited. We waited for Deborah to hear from God that it was time to fight. One day turned into another as the Canaanites taunted us from below. "Hey, scaredy cats, come out and play with the big kids." Why didn't they come up after us? There were rugged paths up the hill, even a dusty road. They could cross that river on the plain and be right at our throats. They could move off that grass. Grass. Tasty grass. Body-rubbing grass, soft and fragrant. They could move off that grass, and it would be all mine. Then, one morning, as I was lost in such a daydream, Deborah looked at the sky, turned to Barak, and said, "Now. God says the time is now." With his hand raised to signal the troops, Barak bound forward and we raced into formation. It had rained all night, gentle pounding that left the ground refreshed. As we thundered down the hill, the wind was at our backs and pushed us even faster. Horses can gallop through anything, and our foot soldiers raced nimbly behind us. Nothing would stop us. We had people at home to protect. Minute by minute, the rains grew heavier, blowing straight ahead. Thunder and lightning boomed and flashed, along with one particularly eerie sound, the clicking of the knives on the Canaanite chariot wheels. Boom, flash, click, boom, click. We could see the river rising and the ground getting muddy. The Canaanites marched forward, their hate-filled faces coming into focus. And then this happened. Just as we prepared to swim and lunge through the river, torrents of water spilled over the riverbanks, swamping the ground below. Those lovely grass fields were suddenly muddy pools, leaving all 900 chariots stuck in the mud. No longer did their wheels roll. No longer did their knives click. Now I knew why the Canaanites hadn't surged the hill. Their chariots only worked on dry and flat ground. "This was God's work," said Deborah. "No wonder we had to wait. God made it rain so the river would rise." For the Canaanites, the battle was over. They raised their hands in defeat, except for one figure off to the side limping into the woods. Sisera, the leader of the Canaanite army, was trying to escape. Deborah watched him, gave a small smile, and encouraged Barak to turn the troops homeward. Odd, I thought. Odd. Why not go after him? Why was she letting such an evil man slip away? Deborah has returned to her role as a judge and a wife and a mother. I live happily in my field, enjoying all the grass I could ever want. All of our soldiers have returned to their families, and everyone is now safely out of danger, thanks to the soldiers' bravery. Peace and God again rule our land. And Sisera, that mean general, turns out that he stumbled into the home of a woman named Jael. She quietly punished him for his evil deeds so that he would never hurt anyone again. The end. If you want to read more of this story and more of the details about what happened to Sisera, Judges chapter 5 is about where this happens. I have a question you don't need to answer. You're all laughing out of relief. What does justice look like? It's a big concept, and I think we probably could ponder that for a long time. That was the concept, that was a question I spent a chunk of the week pondering. Because Jesus tells a story today, and it comes across a little weird. Because Luke has framed it as a story about prayer. And sometimes we call it the story of the unjust judge or the story of the persistent widow. But there's really no consensus about what this story means or how we should read it. So I spent the week pondering what justice looks like. If we were to try to define justice, what does that mean? I don't have a good answer. That's not where this is going. We aren't arriving at some simple definition of justice that you can all take home. I'm sorry. Because the more time I spent pondering justice, the more I had to wonder what actually happened in this story. Luke sets us up as a story about prayer, but I want us to sort of set that aside for right now because I don't think that framework serves us well or speaks well to what prayer is or how we communicate with God, which might be one simple definition of prayer. I can tell you that. But the story itself it's sort of an odd story. Jesus says, in a town there was a widow who kept going to a judge and saying, well, and this is where it gets tricky, because in the text we read, it says, grant me justice. But that's not quite what the Greek means. The Greek is a little more complex. The Greek that this was first written down in has the widow coming to the judge and saying, avenge me. Now, avenge and justice are not always the same thing, are they? We tend to read vengeance as sort of a bloodthirsty, our darker halves want that type of concept. In the tradition of Israel, avenge me can also be the less powerful person coming to the more powerful person and saying, help me find justice. So the Greek avenge me could mean what the widow wants is not justice, or it could mean that she needs someone powerful to speak for her. Because as a widow, she doesn't have a male person, and in most of Israel, you needed a male person to interact with the legal system. So maybe this is a story about a widow who wants justice. Maybe this is a story about a widow who wants vengeance. Whether that vengeance is sort of bloodthirsty and just or not. And then we have the judge. In the story itself, he's just a judge. We're told he's unjust later. So set that aside for now. And the judge says, though I have no respect for God or for people, I'm going to do what this widow asks because it's clear she will give me no peace until I do. Or at least, that's mostly what the judge says in the text as we read it. In the Greek, the text is more complicated. In the Greek, the judge is scared. The verb translates into something It literally translates into something like, he's worried the widow will give him a black eye. Which means that maybe what the judge has finally done is something that is just. Maybe he has finally heard the pleas of someone who needs people in power to hear their pleas, and he has acted. Or maybe he is just scared and he will do whatever he is sort of bullied into doing. The more time I spent, and this is a short story, it gets complicated really fast sometimes. The more time I spent with this story, the more complicated it got, and the more distant that concept of justice began to seem. I can tell you two things that I do know about this story. We are presented with a widow. And the prophets of the Old Testament and those who came to Israel and said, "This is what God has asked you to do. Why are you not doing it?" The three classes of people that were most often listed as needing protected were widows, orphans, and strangers. Those who existed outside and on the periphery of how Israelite society most often functioned. So maybe when we bring that knowledge to this story, we are meant to read it as a widow who needs protection, who needs someone with power to speak for her. That makes sense. That gives us a sort of lens we can apply to what might be true about the widow and what might be true about the judge. The other thing I know about widows is widows in the Old Testament, when they have a story, are amazing people. These are the stories of Ruth, of Judith, of Jael, who was alluded to in our morsels and stories. These are women who stood in a society that gave them no power and found a way. A way that was maybe not something we would recommend to those around us, but was at the same time just and provided for them and those who depended on them. Widows in the Bible, when they are given a story, are feisty and fierce. They show up when things are unjust, and through their actions, justice is often found in some unexpected way. So maybe the widow in this story, if we use that lens, is feisty and fierce. Maybe what she is asking for is justice for her, or maybe there is something unequal in the situation she's trying to rectify, even if it is not the decision the judge would usually have made. We don't know. But what those widows of the Old Testament, those women who are feisty and fierce, who talk back to prophets and seek what is necessary for their health and their safety, do tell us is that when we are talking about justice and God, the answer is often not what we would expect. It comes to people we think might be entirely lost to society. Strangers and widows, people with no family. And sometimes in the text, all of those things apply to the same person. But when that person is Ruth, who is widowed young and left her family to go back with her mother-in-law, she becomes part of the genealogy of David. When that person is a widow in Zarephath, who Elijah is sent to, who is prepared to make her last food and then starve to death with her son, A prophet shows up on her doorstep, and after she sort of chides him for asking for the very last of her very meager resources, she is provided for throughout an entire famine, though she is not of Israel, though she has no one important, and even though she got a little mouthy, I think is the best term for it. God's justice puts murderers leading people into freedom. It raises adulterers as the greatest king of Israel. It calls tax collectors to be disciples. It gives a woman the charge of speaking the gospel of the resurrection for the very first time in history. God's justice doesn't do what we often think of as justice. So I don't know what is true about this widow and this judge. Maybe she is kind of mean and grabbing for more than what she deserves. Maybe he is weak-willed and willing to give in to get a troublesome case off his desk. Maybe she is feisty and fierce and seeking the kind of justice God often brings out of situations that look impossible. And maybe he can finally hear that truth. That might be up to you to sort out. But here's what I know. In a parable that we are told is about an unjust judge, the work God is about in this somewhere is not the work that makes sense in our society. Whatever God is doing is not the ruling that a judge in one of our courts would hand down. It is not something most of us would look at and go, of course that was going to happen. The work God is about will be surprising. It will somehow upset society to bring it closer to the kingdom of God, where widows are feisty and we are to protect them, and those that have less. Where the people we would today write off or lock up often also have the gifts of leadership that God is looking for. The justice of God is a place where outsiders are often the most important people in the room. I don't have a short synopsis of what justice is or what justice should be for you. But I have a question, one that I have been wondering about for days now. How does our work help illuminate the justice that God brings about in this world? Are we able to hear what God is doing? Are we waiting to be surprised by the results that God often offers forth as victory? Amen.